Hello, I'm Norman Swan and this is the Health Report. In this program, a condition which has been a bit of a battleground between parents, researchers, doctors, psychologists and even the media. It's called autism spectrum disorder and has been diagnosed in increasing numbers in Australia and overseas. Some people say it's an epidemic on the rise and blame vaccines like the measles, mumps, rubella immunisation or even mercury that's been used as a preservative in vaccines. Some argue that autism spectrum disorder is just the new ADHD, with paediatricians under pressure from stressed parents medicalising normal behaviour in children. So what is this disorder? Is it really on the rise? Have vaccines any role to play? What's new research discovering about toxic substances in pregnancy and findings in families where there are children with this problem? For example, do like-minded men and women marry and have like-minded children? That's what today's Health Report is about. And earlier this year, I talked to two leading researchers in North America. One is John Constantino, who's Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Pediatrics at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He's been particularly interested in giving doctors and psychologists easier ways of diagnosing the problem, because the debate has been about whether diagnoses like autism and Asperger's, where the person has normal intelligence, are actually well-defined conditions like heart attacks or asthma, or whether they just shade into normality when you go down the scale. John Constantino.
That's correct. What our data supports more is a continuous distribution in the entire population, the extreme of which represents autism. But to draw any kind of dividing line between autism and somewhat less than autism and somewhat less than that are only arbitrary categorizations.
You've developed a measure, and we'll come back to that in a moment, because you can actually quantify this situation objectively.
Right.
But just remind us, what are the sort of traits that you're looking at that lead you to assume that somewhere on the spectrum you've got something that's close to autism?
Sure. The syndrome of autism rests on problems in three different domains. One is deficits in reciprocal social behavior. That is turn-taking, you say, I say, I do something, you respond to that. Social interaction. And children with autism spectrum conditions manifest deficiency in this from very early in life. That deficiency can either be in recognizing social cues of another person when they're present, or it can be in appropriately interpreting those cues, or it can be in appropriately responding to those cues. There can be problems in any of those domains.
The net result is that you have a child who becomes progressively socially isolated.
That's correct.
An intellectual delay is not necessarily part of that story.
Not at all. It is becoming increasingly apparent that although autism does co-occur with mental retardation, that the majority of children with autism are of average intellectual ability.
The autism is like separate from their intelligence.
That's correct.
I was once ticked off by an Australian expert in autism who said you should never talk about autism in terms of being severe and mild, because even what some people might say is the mild end of the scale, if you talk to that person, they'll say they're severely disabled by their impairment.
That's actually a true statement. You know, it depends on where you're talking about on the bell curve, as it were. Children who fall just below what would be considered clinical cutoffs for the level of social impairment that most people would agree qualifies for a diagnosis of autism are still quite socially impaired, in the same way that a child who has an IQ of 71, even though they don't meet the formal cutoff for a diagnosis of mental retardation, are clearly affected by having an intellectual ability that's in that range of the spectrum.
So what are the other two domains that you look at?
Communication. And the communicative deficits in autism range from never developing the ability to use verbal language to odd or idiosyncratic use of language.
Such as?
Well, such as, for example, being able to perceive what another person says to you verbally, but in trying to organize your own thoughts and respond in a way that is logical, that serves cause and effect, you just can't put it all together the right way. You can observe children who are literally trying to get an idea across in a conversation, are having some kind of idea that they're trying to share, but the way in which it comes out is in many ways uninterpretable. Even though they're using words and they're placing words one in front of the other, there are bits and pieces that are intelligible, but they may be well off the mark of the relevance to the conversation. They may talk around the subject in very unusual ways, Or, you know, they may repeat things in a perseverative way. So they may make a phrase or a sentence and then issue it again and again repeatedly in a non-purposeful kind of way.
And the third is behavioral, isn't it?
The third is behavioral, repetitive behaviors. These are non-purposeful, repetitive kinds of behavior that include hand flapping, that include rocking in the most severe cases.
And is this where savant or obsessions, like obsessions with railway engines or, you know, street lamps and that sort of thing, is that in the behavioral category?
That's correct, because we lump mental perseverations or preoccupations in the same category with those kinds of stereotypic behaviors.
Now, you've developed your own scale here, and there are several scales out here. There's a market for them.
Yeah.
So give me the sales pitch for your scale.
Right. Well, I don't wish to give a sales pitch.
Just to explain here, I mean, what we're talking about here is not like high cholesterol, where you can do a blood test and you say, yep, you've got high cholesterol, here is it. We're talking about a spectrum disorder like ADHD, where you've got to draw a line in the sand, and it's pretty arbitrary. It's more like high blood pressure, where you've got a normal distribution of blood pressure in the population, and arbitrarily we say, look, at this level, you're more likely to get a heart attack or stroke.
Correct.
And you've got a normal distribution of autistic kind of behavior. We've all got these like little traits.
Right.
Just sometimes it gets more severe, and you've got to draw a line in the sand, and that's why you have these complicated questionnaires and scales.
Well, let's back up, because at the time when we developed the scale, no one really knew that there was a continuous distribution of traits. The handwriting was on the wall that relatives of children with autism seem to have subtle traits like those that are observed in autism, but they had only been very crudely measured. And in fact, there was no method for measuring sub-threshold autistic traits, that is, traits that fell below what one would consider diagnostic. The measures that had been developed prior to that to establish caseness in a clinical sense, so that everybody could agree in research and in clinical settings and in schools who's affected and who's not.
So clearly over the line rather than just marginally above or marginally below.
That's correct. I mean, some of those measures can distinguish children who seem to be somewhat affected, but the focus of those instruments is to establish caseness, is to establish who falls into this category. When we developed the scale, we were interested in children who may not have full-blown autism, or who may have subtler degrees of impairment, that none of the scales were really able to measure or quantify in a way that made sense. So, for example, there were children who a physician would see and say, I think this kid has pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which is the mildest of the autism spectrum conditions.
And the most criticized.
Most criticized, because there was no way to actually affirm the diagnosis except for a clinician to say, I think this kid's got it. And so the clinician would write a note or call the school and say, I think this kid's got PDD-NOS. And the school would say, well, what do you want us to do about it? Then the clinician might say, well, we would like you to apply the same sorts of interventions to this child as to children with autism.
And that was the criticism that was given, so that they got a teacher's assistant or the school could get extra facilities, because only by getting the label would you actually get help for this child who's got this something going on, but what is it?
That's right. And there was a lot of disagreement about the label. That is to say, when one person would say, why do you think that this child has PDD-NOS? Well, they're very odd, or they're very strange, or they're very weird, but they don't necessarily meet criteria for autism. So that was the state of affairs when we thought it would be useful to develop a scale that could quantify severity, not only in the severe range for autism, but even in the mild range and even in the unaffected range, thinking that, you know, we could test the hypothesis of whether or not subtle traits of this nature actually aggregated in families of children with autism, and to actually be able to make a measurement and give a metric, like we do for IQ, that everybody can agree on.
So using the skills and experience of a broad range of professionals, they developed a fairly simple test which doesn't require a lot of training to administer. You're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National, and we'll come back to John Constantino later about his fascinating findings in families. With a greater ability to recognise the full range of problems in the autism spectrum came a belief that we were actually in the middle of an epidemic, and that that epidemic was growing inexorably with pernicious causes such as vaccines. Someone who's been at the centre of that debate is Eric Fombonne, Professor of Child Psychiatry at McGill University in Montreal.
Well, it depends on the question being asked. If the question is there more children today diagnosing autism or autism spectrum disorder as compared to 30 or 40 years ago, the answer is yes. We do diagnose more often these conditions than we used to do in the past. Does that mean that there is an epidemic of autism? No. And the reason is as follows. 40 years ago, the diagnostic criteria that we used for diagnosing autism were relatively narrow. So we were really looking at children who were often mentally retarded, had no language or very abnormal language development. At the time, we did not recognize that autism could also occur in children with normal intellectual functioning, children with an IQ of 100 or 120, or who could have good language development, for instance. And therefore, it's not a surprise that we are actually now diagnosing autism spectrum disorders in a higher number of children than in the past.
But the proponents of the argument that say that it's truly gone up, that it's not a diagnostic phenomenon, they point to studies, I think, in California and elsewhere, and they say that when you compare apples with apples, there is a rise still.
No, there is actually no such data, and the California data have been misused to put this argument forward. So I know them very well, and I can tell you, for instance, that today there is about 29,000 clients registered in the California Department of Services database. 29,000 subjects today. If you look at the population of California today, it's about 36 million, of which you have about 8.5 million who are between the ages of 3 and 17. So if you apply to these 8.5 million people aged 3 to 17, the current rates that we have for autism spectrum disorder, which is 0.6%, you expect to have in California in this age group at least 50,000 subjects. Okay. If you have a more conservative rate, it would be like even like at least 30,000 subjects. So the fact that there are not even 30,000 subjects for all age groups in this California database clearly does not suggest that there is an epidemic. The fact that the numbers have increased over time is good. It means that more children are accessing the public services, whereas in the past they were not. In the past, these children, because there was no systematic effort to give them treatment or services, children were not accessing services or they were subsumed under different diagnostic categories. And we have evidence from several studies that there have been diagnostic switching. So in the early 80s, it was better to be diagnosed with a diagnosis of mental retardation than with autism, because autism did not really give you access to any kind of good services, whereas if you were mentally retarded or recognized as such, you had actually access to a range of services. And there was a big shift which occurred in the US in the early 1990s. There was a change in the Individual Disabilities Educational Act, which is a federal law which mandates each state to provide services for subjects with various handicaps. And autism became a mandatory reporting condition by states, whereas it was not the case before. So suddenly you had a big shift. States started to count and report autism as a separate condition, and states were also mandated to provide services for this population, and that occurred in the early 1990s. And if you look at all the trends in all states in the US in 1990, 91, 92, you can see this rise in the numbers of children who are identified with an autism spectrum condition. So the fact that it has risen reflects that there was change in the law, there were new awareness of the conditions, better services, and it cannot be interpreted as an epidemic.
And you studied this in Quebec, in school registers. What have you found here?
We surveyed a big school board, which has about 30,000 children from kindergarten to grade 11, and we obtained a rate of PDD, including all forms of PDD, autism, Asperger, atypical autism, PDD-NOS, for the children who do not meet the full criteria for autism.
And you found the same rate as others have found elsewhere in the world?
We just reported a rate of 0.65%, which means that about one child in 160 in our communities is affected with an autism spectrum disorder. That rate has been now reported by at least 10 different studies. When I was in the UK, I did two studies which confirmed this high estimate.
And you've also used this database to actually investigate two of the immunization theories, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and the other one, which is, could it have been mercury preservative in some vaccines?
Yes, we were fortunate to investigate in that survey birth cohorts of children born between 1987 and up to 1998. So we looked at whether or not there were some change in the vaccination schedule or vaccination rates to look at relationship between rates of autism on the one hand and immunization policies. To discuss the MMR issue first, we were looking at first the coverage of MMR during that period. And in fact,
it should be said before you go on, you were working in the UK when this whole thing hit the press.
Yes, when the 1998 Wakefield story started in
Wakefield being the researcher who put it out there.
Yes, we put the question about the link between MMR and autism. I was in the UK and I was dragged into the review of his hypothesis and subsequently did research which did not support this hypothesis. Yet, it's a very important question in the UK and in some parts of the world because people have actually stopped to use MMR vaccines in young children. And as a result of that, we have seen epidemics of measles occurring in Ireland, in London, where actually young children have died from measles again. So it's a very serious issue.
Both even Tony Blair hesitated, I gather.
Absolutely. People were wondering whether Leo Blair had been vaccinated with MMR. And the tabloid press in the UK is still very active on this issue, although the science has consistently failed to give support to the hypothesis. But yet the consequences are there, and they are extremely negative. They are negative for the families who have children with autism, who worry about the fact that the autism in their child could have occurred through an MMR vaccine, which it did not, and secondly, for the public health issue.
And what have you done here?
So what we looked at is whether or not there was we could find any relationship between our trends in the rates of PDDs, which were increasing between 1987 to 1998 in Quebec, and in fact, during the same period, the coverage with MMR by the population, in fact, statistically decreased, again, suggesting that there is no relationship between the increase in PDD and the decrease in vaccine MMR uptake by parents. That was the first hypothesis that we tested. What happened is that in Quebec in 1996, they decided to not only give one MMR shot at 12 months of age, as is usually done, but a second one, a booster, at 18 months of age. So we could actually test whether or not the introduction in 1996 of a second MMR dose in the immunization schedule would actually had step up the rates of PDDs, and in fact, all the modeling techniques that we've used failed to show that it had any effect on the rates of PDDs.
Thimerosal, mercury?
But the thimerosal issue is more important. And the thimerosal issue has to do with the fact that we have used over the years small amounts of ethyl mercury in the vaccines to stabilize the vaccines in multiple dose vials. In Quebec, again, we are fortunate that in the period that we studied, there were changes in how much mercury was used in the vaccine. So from 1987 to 1991, there was a dose of about 100 and 125 micrograms of ethyl mercury in the vaccines. And then, because we introduced new vaccines in 1992, the dose to which young children were exposed before age 2 actually rose to 200 and even 225 micrograms. And then what happened in Quebec is that in 1996, they decided to combine these four vaccines, DCP, HIB, with the polio vaccine, which is a live attenuated vaccine. And because live vaccines cannot tolerate the use of thimerosal, thimerosal was altogether removed from the vaccines in 1996. So we had a wonderful natural experiment where we could look at whether or not our trends in our rates of PDDs were bearing any relationship with variability in the levels of exposure to thimerosal, and in fact, all the techniques that we used failed to show that there was any relationship between the two phenomena.
But you didn't give up. You went searching further because you've done this fascinating study of hair and nail analysis of children, parents, and controls.
Yes, you know, we assess in our clinic every day young children age 2, 3, 4, and we often do blood tests on them to just look at chromosomes, abnormalities. So I decided to piggyback on this clinical practice and to do a bit more in terms of biological investigations in order to address the public concerns about mercury, but also because I thought that if it's not mercury, there will be maybe a concern with arsenic or lead or other kinds of neurotoxicants in the years to come. So we, in fact, over 2 years, sampled like 70 or 75 young children recently diagnosed with PDDs, in which we've collected a lot of data, IQ, behavior, sleep patterns, diary, to look at what they eat over a period of time. And we measured in their blood and in their nails and in their hair various neurotoxicants. And we did that in the mothers too.
There was the whole thing about mercury in fish and pregnancy.
Yeah, because people can eat various things which contains high levels of mercury, or they might have some difficulty to excrete mercury. And we recruited about 70 pediatric controls so that we could compare the two groups. And we have now communicated our preliminary findings, which in terms of the mercury levels are not different in the autistic children compared to the controls, suggesting that the autism is unlikely to occur through some form of increased exposure to mercury or through a deficit in excretion of mercury in autism.
So is your view now, coming to the cause, that it's all genetic, there are few environmental influences?
The bulk of the evidence we have today is that genetic factors play a very important role in autism. We have heritability estimates which are largely over 90%.
90% hereditability?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, you know, if you look at twins, for instance, if the twin pairs, if one child has autism, the likelihood that the other one would be autistic is about 70%. If the pair is monozygotic, they are identical twins. If they are fraternal twins, in other words, they share only 50% of their genes, the likelihood that the other one would be autistic is just like 5, maybe 8%. Now, it's fair to say that because the concordance rates in identical twin pairs are not 100%, there is some scope for some environmental factors playing in some cases an additional role. And people have been looking at various possible risk factors. We have evidence that some exposures during the prenatal period to particular toxic substances might lead to autism in some cases. And there are some very unique studies showing that exposure, for instance, to valproic acid, which is
Epilim, an anti-epileptic drug.
An anti-epileptic, which is used to treat bipolar disorders in psychiatry, when it is given at particular time during the pregnancy, and we are talking about the first trimester, and in fact, often between the 20th and the 26th day of gestation, might increase the risk of autism in some studies. We have also some studies looking at similar effect of another medication used to abort, in fact, which is called misoprostol, that some young women take, but of course it doesn't work all the time, and therefore we followed up some pregnancies.
This is the prostaglandin infusion,
yes,
that some people get, particularly.
Exactly, and in some studies based in Brazil, there seems to be an increased risk of autism in the offsprings of these mothers. And we have a few other leads like that, suggesting that particular substances to which the fetus might be exposed at particular times during the pregnancy, especially the first trimester, might be increasing the risk of autism. Now, these are important leads to follow. They do not account for the bulk of the cases, because when we look at kids with autism, they usually have had normal pregnancies with no exposure to medication or no abnormal problems.
Eric Fombon, who's professor of child psychiatry at McGill University in Montreal. Let's return to John Constantino at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, who, you remember, developed a way of assessing the full range of autistic-like symptoms, ranging from normality right through to full-blown autism. And he's been using the test to assess whole families.
What we've found is that when you assess the presumed unaffected siblings of children with autism spectrum conditions, there's a spread of symptoms if you take all the SIBs as a group, but the mean, the average for those siblings is substantially higher than what you see in the general population, higher being less socially competent. The higher your score on the SRS, the more autistic traits you have. And so these children, although they are presumed unaffected, as a group have some degree of being affected.
Which doesn't necessarily mean it's genetic. They could be growing up in households which encourage that kind of communication.
That's correct. But we've also looked in the general population and have found some very interesting things about the genetics of these traits. The first thing that we found in the general population when we studied twins was that the traits were extremely highly heritable at the same level as is presumed for autism itself. We've studied not only twins but also their parents, and this has been some of the most interesting findings with respect to how things flow in family. So with the twins, we were fairly certain that the heritability was extremely high. But then it still raises the question of how does that get transmitted from generation to generation? Well, we looked at the parents of our twins, and the correlations between a twin and his or her parent, whether mother or father, is just as strong as the correlation between two non-identical twins for this trait. In other words, there are tremendous intergenerational correlations. Parents show many of the same traits and symptoms. When you look at the parents, it turns out that if both parents are in the upper quartile of the distribution for SRS traits,
meaning that they're in the top 25% of the thing, which is getting pretty severe.
It's not really severe. It's just the top 25%. I mean, you know, one out of four people that you've seen today, maybe more, are in the top 25%. So that's not a, it's not a severe cutoff or criterion. But if both parents are in the top 25%, it raises the likelihood that one of their children will be in the clinical range for an autism spectrum disorder by tenfold. So the idea is that these traits are highly genetically determined, they're continuously distributed, having parents who, each of whom, have a little bit of degree of being affected, they have offspring, and those offspring have a tenfold increase in risk for having clinical level impairment. The way that this is segregating looks like the intergenerational transmission of additive genetic influences.
So, and of course, one of the environmental things could be that couples are attracted to each other because they found somebody who has the same peculiar way of identifying with the world.
We could test that, and we did. And it turned out that the correlation between parents for autistic trait scores are just as high as for brothers and sisters. So this underscores the whole notion of preferential mating for these traits. And we certainly view it as a preliminary finding and one that will require replication. But it is quite likely that there is a way in which individuals who are alike one another, both in terms of social competence or relative social not-so-competence, find each other. And one of the ways that we found that in this, and again, this is one of the advantages of using a general population sample, is you can ask the question of how many couples in your population could be categorized as mom and dad both in the upper quartile, mom and dad both in the lower quartile, or opposites where
dad's a mixed marriage.
Or a mixed marriage. And the same type parents outnumber the mixed type parents by something like 4-1. So by chance, if there was random mating, that wouldn't happen. So there is a very strong inclination for these individuals, at least at the extremes, to find each other.
What does this tell us about helping such people?
What it tells me is that we must find the genes, and we must find the products of those genes.
So you're thinking drugs are the answer?
Not necessarily, because it's possible that entirely genetic conditions can be treated by environmental methods. One of our examples in medicine is phenylketonuria, which is a completely genetic disease that is a defect in an enzyme that metabolizes phenylalanine, which is an amino acid.
And if you remove it from the diet, you don't ever get the disease.
That's correct, because the accumulation, in the absence of that enzyme, the accumulation of that amino acid is neurotoxic. And there are many, many gene-environment interactions that are starting to appear in the scientific literature for all kinds of things, including complex behavioral traits, including antisocial development, aggression, violence. So there may be very interesting gene-environment interactions. Gene-environment interactions tend to get lumped into the category of what we call genetics in terms of what explains variation in outcome. But deeply entangled in all that may be significant interactions between genes and environments.
John Constantino is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. I'm Norman Swan, and you've been listening to The Health Report.